Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nancy Lefson and Charlie Richardson of the group Military Families Speak Out, who discuss the ongoing war in Iraq, the Pentagon's extension of combat duty for U.S. troops, and the possibility of a military draft. Melinda Tuhus reports on the March for Women's Lives, which drew a million people to the nation's capital who protested the Bush administration's attack on abortion and reproductive rights. And David Levy, an organizer with the Mobilization for Global Justice, who assesses demonstrations held in Washington, D.C., protesting the policies of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund on the financial institution's 60th anniversary. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
It's been 20 years since the images of starving children in Ethiopia shocked the world and inspired huge benefit concerts like Live Aid. Since the 1984 famine, the African nation has experienced seven more food crises, often with little media attention. The last drought in 2003 left 13 million Ethiopians at risk of starvation. According to the World Press Review magazine, there are many causes for chronic famine other than drought. They include deforestation, soil erosion, and a wood fuel crisis. Many experts say that Ethiopia's massive poverty and its land tenure system that resembles feudalism are the primary triggers for famine. Currently, 82% of the Ethiopian people must survive on less than a dollar a day. In September 2002, the government launched a new anti-poverty strategy sanctioned by the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. The aim was to reduce hunger by boosting farm productivity through the use of more fertilizer and pesticides. But the program did not question existing land use patterns, and critics fear that poor farmers may be forced off small plots. A different development model is being pushed by Ethiopia's Forum for Social Studies, which calls for combining communal ownership of land with private ownership. The program, allowing communities to buy land that farmers want to sell, would be a return to traditional community-based land tenure, which has been uprooted by recent governments. The American Prospect magazine reports that the right wing of the Republican Party is up in arms over President George Bush's immigrant guest worker proposal. Conservative activists in Western states who are strongly opposed to legal immigration are backing new anti-immigrant ballot measures in California, Colorado, and Arizona. One of the leaders in the new anti-immigrant charge is Colorado's Congressman Tom Tancredo. He would make it impossible for undocumented immigrants to get library cards, vaccinations, and other social services. In Arizona, the anti-immigrant ballot measure, dubbed Protect Arizona Now, has the support of 82% of registered Republicans in the southwestern state. Yet many Republican political operatives fear these anti-immigrant ballot questions will only boost Latino turnout and help Democrats. U.S. Senator Jim Colby, a key backer of the Bush guest worker plan, felt the wrath of conservatives in mid-January when he traveled to rural Cochise County, Arizona, a main crossing point for immigrants from Mexico. At a community meeting, the Arizona senator was heckled, and an effigy of a murdered Border Control agent was displayed with the words, "Bush Amnesty." Tom Evan of the Southwest Arizona Republican Club claimed that Colby had turned his back on America. He said, "Many of us believe Colby does not deserve to be a Republican." The testimony of former American Indian Movement activist Kamook Nichols has shaken the credibility of Leonard Peltier, who's been in prison 27 years, convicted of killing two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1975. An international movement maintains that Peltier was framed. In February, Nichols appeared at the murder trial of an AIM security guard, Arlo Looking Cloud, who was convicted of killing AIM activist Anna Mae Pictou Aquash. In her testimony, Nichols said that Peltier had bragged of killing the two FBI agents in cold blood. She also implied that Peltier could have aided in the murder of Pictou Aquash. John Graham, another Ames security guard, is charged with her murder and awaits extradition from Canada. According to the news magazine In These Times, Peltier's lawyer Barry Bachrach blasted Nichols' testimony as coming from a paid government informant. Nichols has admitted to getting $42,000 from the federal government to relocate after testifying, fearing retribution. International supporters like author Peter Matheson maintain Peltier's innocence. However, there are growing doubts among Native American activists and journalists. Reporter Karen Testerman grew up on the Pine Ridge Reservation in the 1970s and once called for Peltier's release. She has now changed her mind based on inside accounts from Native Americans about what happened. In another sign of turmoil, Robert Rabideau, Peltier's spokesman, resigned in early March over unresolved questions about the murder of AIM activist Anna Mae Pictou Aquash. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
In the month of April, more than 100 U.S. soldiers were killed during intensifying combat across Iraq. Over 1,000 Iraqis have also lost their lives during the same period in the two most conflicted areas of the country, Fallujah and Najaf, where standoffs between American troops and insurgents have continued for weeks. As the White House sticks to its original schedule for the symbolic handover of sovereignty to an as-yet-unknown provisional government in Iraq on June 30th, the Pentagon is sending more troops to Iraq and extending the duty of American soldiers already deployed in the country. But even after the handover of sovereignty, Washington will remain firmly in control for years to come. Mark Grossman, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, affirmed recently that the U.S. will not tolerate any decisions made by a transitional Iraqi government which are at variance with American foreign policy. During the past year, when over 700 U.S. servicemen and women have died in Iraq, the White House has prevented the media from taking photos of the flag-draped coffins of soldiers returning to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. But through a Freedom of Information request made by the MemoryHole.org website, the Pentagon was forced to release several hundred such photos. Soon after, the Seattle Times published on their front page a photo of coffins taken by a Pentagon contractor, Tammy Silicio, who was later fired. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nancy Lesson and Charlie Richardson of the group Military Families Speak Out about the ongoing war in Iraq, the Pentagon's extension of combat duty for U.S. troops, and the possibility of a military draft. The couple's son was, until last year, deployed with the U.S. Marine Corps in Iraq.
One of the things that was so painful among many that George Bush said in his latest press conference was something about we can't let soldiers who have died thus far to have died in vain. We heard that very same thing 30-some-odd years ago. At the point where they started saying that, we suggest that people go to the Vietnam Memorial, stand there, and then look at the names that came after that. How many more died when they started saying we have to keep this war going so that those who have died have not died in vain? We're seeing the same thing. We don't want blood shed after blood, all for no good reason. And that's, we really do believe that this was a war that was based on lies, and it is about oil markets and empire building. None of our loved ones should have been sent there in the first place. And the only way to really move the situation in any good direction has to be to end the U.S. military occupation.
There are many observers, politicians, and even military people themselves. They say even if the war was ill-founded and not a necessary war, a war we shouldn't be fighting, the fact is we're there now and we have to find some way to help the Iraqi people put things back together before we leave. How do you respond to that?
Well, first, it's ridiculous ridiculous to say that the people who are making decisions right now about this war are doing anything in the interests of the Iraqi people. And so the idea that keeping them making the decisions, keeping them with 130,000, 150,000 troops over there is somehow going to solve the crisis in Iraq is ridiculous. I mean, it outrages me that people can even say that, that the people who caused the problem, the people who sent us in there cynically based on lies, are not the people that can solve this problem. The only way to take the first step to solving this problem is to end the occupation and remove the U.S. troops. We've caused many, many deaths, thousands of deaths. We've destroyed a lot of infrastructure. We've littered the landscape with depleted uranium. We have a responsibility, but it's not a military responsibility, and it can't be carried out under a military occupation.
We've just had an episode where a newspaper in Seattle recently published the photos of flag-draped coffins coming back from Iraq, the first photos that we've seen here in America, given that the White House has censored those photos for the past year since the war began. Tell us a little bit about your view of that issue as a family of servicemen.
Well, I'll do a little more than that. We actually were down at the gates of Dover on March 14th. We were there with military families who have lost loved ones. We were there with military families whose loved ones are over there. We were there with veterans from a number of different wars, from Veterans for Peace, and we were there with a lot of other organizations. And we were there to say to this administration, stop hiding the toll of this war. We said, start telling the truth. We felt that the American people have the right to understand the human cost of this war. We asked for two things at the gates of Dover Air Force Base on March 14th. One was that families who have lost loved ones be encouraged and be allowed to go to Dover or any other base that their loved ones are flown into to be able to greet the coffins and greet their loved ones. For many of our members who have lost loved ones in Iraq, that has not been their experience, and they have been strongly discouraged, if not outright prevented, from going to receive their loved ones. And the second thing that we asked for was for the media to be allowed in to be able to film the caskets, film the coffins as they come off. We know that this administration is well aware of the power of those images. Certainly back again in the Vietnam War, those images were very powerful in helping to galvanize a nation against another war that should not have happened.
There's been a lot of talk on Capitol Hill recently about reintroducing a military draft in this country, given how our current military is stretched thin with the various engagements in Afghanistan, Iraq, and at bases all around the world, I believe 114 bases total. Tell us your view. What do you think about the institution of a new draft to include those wealthier folks and their children who seemingly think this is a war without cost to them personally?
No, we don't think that we're probably going to see a draft until after the election, but may well see one then. And this idea that it will be an equal opportunity draft, we have grave doubts about, because rich people and people with means such as George Bush have always found a way to get them and their loved ones out of it. The idea to talk about, you know, who goes over, it's generally, you know, working and poor people fighting the rich men's war. That's been time immemorial. And what can you do if those who had to make the decision about going to war were putting up at risk their sons and daughters, their husbands and wives? Perhaps that would make a difference. But the reality, we believe, is that right now we have to talk about ending this war now and ending the policies that allowed it to happen.
That was Nancy Lesson and Charlie Richardson of the group Military Families Speak Out. Visit the group's websites at www.mfso.org or www.bringthemhomenow.org. According to an actual count made by the organizers of the March for Women's Lives, about 1 million people came to Washington, D.C. on April 25th to stand up for abortion rights and other issues of critical concern to women. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus was there and filed this report.
Rallygoers filled the entire mall between the Washington Monument and the Congress building, before snaking into the streets of Washington to express their demands for protecting and expanding reproductive rights, including abortion, birth control, and women's health care in general. The call was for, quote, choice, justice, access, health, abortion, global, and family planning, unquote. But protecting abortion rights was the overwhelming primary objective, and John Kerry was the overwhelming choice of the man for the job. The day before the march, Kerry had made yet another strong pro-choice speech. Frances Kissling, founder and longtime president of Catholics for a Free Choice, alluded to Kerry and other politicians when she spoke at the morning rally.
I am here to tell you that we will not put up with religious leaders who tell us that pro-choice Catholic policymakers can't receive communion. That is a sin.
Some women had wondered before the march if young women, those who had been born after the Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade legalized abortion in 1973, would come to the rally, since they had no personal experience with the horrors of illegal abortion. But an estimated one-third of the marchers were under 25, and that included quite a few men along with hundreds of thousands of women. Tanya Hanel is a 21-year-old student at Swarthmore, an elite college outside Philadelphia. She said she came to demand equal access by all women to the same choices she enjoys.
We needed to come out and show our support for other people who don't have access to all of the forms of contraception, and just realizing that we've always had the privilege of growing up with the option of abortion and having a choice, and that wasn't always the case. And I think it's time that young people get scared that we would have to go back to the days of coat hangers and secrecy and shame.
At an event held at the edge of the main rally, women who support making the morning after pill available without a prescription passed out free samples of progesterone in tablets known as Plan B. Two physicians in the crowd wrote prescriptions of the drug for anyone requesting it. Both those actions are illegal. Lucy Cantib, a family practitioner from Massachusetts, explained why she did it.
We believe that this form of contraception should be available to everyone over the counter. It's a safe method, and it's being prevented from getting to people because this government doesn't believe that women should control their own bodies. Half of the pregnancies in this country are unplanned. That means that half the time people are getting pregnant and didn't intend to, and at least a good bunch of those people know it pretty soon right afterwards that they didn't mean to do that last night. And if we can help all of those people contracept better, that's going to decrease the number of people who didn't plan to get pregnant.
The march's sponsoring organizations included such usual suspects as the National Organization for Women, NARAL, Planned Parenthood, and the Feminist Majority. Also on board were the American Civil Liberties Union, the Black Women's Health Imperative, and the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. The Latina Institute's Priscilla Padilla described the group's priorities as members marched and chanted in Spanish, "The women united will never be defeated."
I think our main concern is just building, doing a lot of networking with other organizations. We're a small organization, but we have a lot of, we're really strong. We have a lot of energy, but we just need to do more networking with other bigger organizations and just to get the word out there for a lot of immigrant women who don't have a voice, who aren't undocumented immigrant women. The language barrier is a huge problem for Latinas, and we just need to be more adamant about that. Another big concern of us is getting our voice. Like, we have a lot of Congress people that we're working close with, and just working with them to get to be represented more judicially and legislatively.
International delegations of women from 51 countries also attended the march and rally. Speaker after speaker from the stage denounced recent attacks on abortion rights, such as the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act and the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, both passed under a Republican-dominated Congress and White House. Many Democratic politicians and other speakers urged people to stay active after the rally and bring voters to the polls in November in order to usher in a new president. A few hundred anti-abortion protesters lined part of the parade route. One man held a huge banner praising those who murdered abortion providers. One of the rally MCs countered that perspective by calling from the stage.
I'd like to start by having you give a big round of applause to the abortion providers who are here today, who, despite the violence and harassment, make choice a reality for women. Let's give them a big hand.
Other protesters held pictures of fetuses at various stages of development and called on the protesters to defend the rights of the unborn.
End the war on the unborn. Declare a truce on the unborn. declare a truce on the unborn. Declare a truce on the unborn.
The marching women and men responded.
Pro-life, that's a lie. You don't care if women die. Pro-life, that's a lie. You don't care if women die.
Reporting for Between the Lines, I'm Melinda Tuhus in Washington, D.C.
In the days preceding the massive March for Women's Lives rally, several thousand activists came to Washington, D.C. to protest the policies of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund as finance ministers and economists met for their annual spring meetings April 21st through April 24th. The two global financial institutions, founded 60 years ago with the close of World War II, have been targeted in recent years for their promotion of economic policies that critics maintain exacerbate poverty while benefiting wealthy nations and large corporations. As in past years, students, labor activists, environmentalists, and human rights advocates engaged in colorful demonstrations and street theater. Protesters demanded that the World Bank and IMF open their secret meetings to public scrutiny, cancel the corrosive debt owed by impoverished nations, end policies which deny people access to essential services, and stop support for environmentally destructive development projects. Although this year's demonstrations were considerably smaller than past actions and did not employ acts of civil disobedience, organizers say that the movement against corporate-led globalization remains strong, as evidenced by the collapse of recent World Trade Organization talks in Cancun, Mexico, and setbacks in establishing a free trade area of the Americas Treaty. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Levy, an organizer with the Mobilization for Global Justice, who assesses the IMF World Bank protests and the influence opponents have had on changing the policies of the powerful financial institutions.
The Mobilization for Global Justice, or MGJ as it's called, has tried to distill what these institutions do down into four demands. And the demands, broadly speaking, have to do with institutions like the World Bank, IMF, and the World Trade Organization. Those are the what I call the three-headed hydra of corporate globalization. Broadly speaking, they're undemocratic, they're unaccountable, they're not elected, and they're secretive. They meet always behind closed doors, and the minutes of the meeting do not reveal who said what to whom. So what we've done is we've created four demands, and those demands are, one, to open all World Bank and IMF meetings to the media and the public, two, to cancel all impoverished country debt to the World Bank and IMF using the institution's own resources. They often claim that they don't got the money and they will go bankrupt if we were to forgive all impoverished country debt. Three would be to end all World Bank and IMF policies that hinder people's access, that is usually poor people's access, of course, to food, clean water, shelter, health care, education, and the right to organize. These are what the World Bank and IMF euphemistically call structural adjustment policies. And part of those policies are austerity programs that basically require radical belt tightening in the government budget and tends to throw hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people out of work. And the fourth demand is to stop all World Bank support for socially and environmentally destructive projects such as oil, gas, and mining activities, and support for projects such as dams that include the forced relocation of entire communities.
Over the last bunch of years, with increasing attention and focus on the policies of the World Bank and IMF, as well as tens of thousands of demonstrators meeting them at all their gatherings worldwide, has the World Bank and IMF reacted in any positive ways? Have they adjusted or changed their policies in any way to even going halfway to meet your demands?
I wouldn't say that they've gone halfway to meet our demands, but they're certainly feeling the pressure. But it has a long way to go. There, actually, right now, it's kind of a crucial moment. an op-ed writer in the Washington Post, who's actually on the editorial board at the Washington Post, was all a Twitter about the possibility, the scary possibility, that the World Bank and IMF might actually acquiesce to the independent commission's recommendation that the World Bank withdraw from oil, gas, and mining, so-called extractive industries, over a certain period of time. So it looks like there is some movement. There has been some movement, but the World Bank and IMF, they're making slow modifications, way too slow to our mind, but they are making slow modifications. The cause for jubilation in the anti-corporate globalization movement is actually, I would argue, much more a result of what's happened with the World Trade Organization and the so-called free trade agreements, such as the Free Trade Area of the Americas and the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Those three initiatives, the WTO has been stopped in its tracks, the FTAA has been watered down, and now we're calling it FTAA Lite. They still haven't reached an agreement. They're still in negotiations. The CAFTA agreement, it won't even be introduced in Congress, is the prediction now, because it's an election year, and politicians, Democratic and Republican alike, won't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Here in the United States, there are many newspapers and other media outlets that cover the movement and the protests that accompany the World Bank and IMF. And with reduced numbers coming out to these protests, there is a general pronouncement that the movement has lost momentum. How do you respond to the idea that somehow maybe September 11th, the terrorist attacks and the war in Iraq have taken some of the wind out of your sails?
Americans tend to think that the anti-corporate globalization movement was born in 1999 in Seattle during the big protests against the World Trade Organization. It was sort of an explosion on the political scene, on the political map in the United States and Europe. To expect for a movement to maintain that kind of level of intensity after the thousands of assaults that took place as a result under cover of September 11th, I think that would be setting unreasonably high expectations.
That was David Levy, an organizer with Mobilization for Global Justice in Washington, D.C. Contact the group by calling area code 202-288-2283 or visit the group's website at www.globalizethis.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Todd. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Sophia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.